asked me to speak on the book I'm writing, Forgiveness. And I have good news. You're among the first to hear it. On Monday, I finished writing for a while anyways and sent it to the publisher. I had some help from Dr. Emily. She edited the book three times. And some of the Norbertine priests at the Abbey read over the book. And two of them that have quite a voice in the community thinks that the whole community should read the book for the good of the community and as confessors. The man who is in charge of this publishing company, I've known for some years, and one of the top people that works with him, we're also connected. She wants to read the book, and if she likes it, that'll have a positive effect on him. Do I want that book to be published by this company? That's the only choice I have. From the beginning, I wanted this publisher to publish the book. There is no second choice. The book hits hard, whether you're Catholic or Protestant, whether you're pro St. Thomas Aquinas or not, liberal or conservative, it hits hard in so many areas. I don't know if I was a publisher if I would want to deal with that. So yes, it matches his personality, but not quite the books he publishes. So I don't know if he's going to publish it. I might have to tone it down a bit. I don't know what he's going to say. But I'm mentioning this so that you have something specific to pray for. You've been praying for me for a while. I thank you for that. But here is something specific to pray that he will publish the book. It starts with my personal story, my journey from unforgiveness to forgiveness, and then realizing that I'm not the only person in the world that doesn't know what forgiveness is. It comes up so often in the confessional. And people say they haven't forgiven because they're still angry, they still remember. I ask five questions, and if they answer those questions a certain way, then I know they have forgiven, even though they think they haven't. So this book is also for them, people who have been beating themselves up for years, thinking they haven't forgiven, and they just put so much energy into that area, trying to do the impossible, where they could be working on other aspects of their life, okay? I give 15 reasons why we don't know the answer. Each of those reasons stands on their own. Our culture cannot provide us the answer. Those are the answers you give me, and then I shred them, okay? They're not the biblical answer. Now, there's no definition of forgiveness in the Bible. The definition consists of four parts. All four parts are there in the Bible, but there's no one-liner saying, you know, what forgiveness is. And it's very hard to find it in tradition. That's so vast. That includes so much. It's daunting, even for those who want to go in that direction. It's very hard to find the answer. That's why it took me so long. So I after I go through those 15 reasons, then there's like a pre-definition. There's certain words you have to know before you get the definition. Otherwise, you can have the definition, but you don't know what it means. And then the last part of the book is practical ways of expressing forgiveness, or the process of that you go through to forgive. Now, in the confessional, a lot of you say forgiveness means letting go. And once I point to Jesus on the cross, nobody thinks that's Jesus' forgiveness. He's not hanging up there trying to let go. No one thinks that. And then I'll say, in one word, what is Jesus' forgiveness? Most people say love. And I'll say, does forgiveness mean to keep loving the sinner who hurt you? For most people, that rings true. So that's the answer you get in the confessional. But there's a more precise answer than that. But I don't have time to give it to you, so I'm going to give you part of that up here. I'm not going to give you everything, otherwise you won't get the book. So if you want more detail, don't bother asking. If there's something I say that you didn't hear, you could just stop me. Father, I didn't hear what you said, or did you mean to say this? You know, because sometimes I do that. I have one idea, but something else comes out. So you can always stop me for that. All right. So the answer is more full if you throw in the word mercy. Okay? Mercy is one of the effects of charity. I have to go through what charity is because a lot of people don't know what that is. Mercy is very complex. Okay? In the Old Testament in Hebrew, there's no word mercy. The Hebrew language is very simple. These are simple words, more picturesque. It paints a picture, okay? Later on, when you have the Greeks and the Romans, they're more into concepts and they're more into complex ideas. But that's not the Jews. So this first part on mercy has to do with the D word, development. Then I'll give you the second D word, the definition. If there's time, then I'll give you distinctions, okay? Different kinds of mercy. Okay, so the first part, the origin, the development of mercy, where does it start? It starts in the Bible during the time of Moses. Now, this date is controversial. I don't have time to explain it, but I'm just going to say 1400 BC. If you have a problem with that, talk to Tim Staples. God revealed himself to Moses using three Hebrew words: Hanan, Chesed, Racham. Those three words contain the four parts of the definition of mercy. Okay? So it starts with those three words, and then 100 BC, the Pharaoh of Egypt, Ptolemy, wanted the Bible translated into the language of the people, Greek. He's not Jewish, there's no Christianity, and he wants this in his library. He asks the Jews to translate it from Hebrew to Greek. Traditionally, it's believed that there was about 70 scholars in 70 days that did this translation. It's called the Septuagint because the Latin word for 70 is Septuaginta. Those three Hebrew words were translated into two Greek words. All right? And then Saint Jerome was asked by Pope Damasus to translate it into the language of the people, Latin. He knew Hebrew, he knew Greek. In the translation, those two Greek words become one Latin word, misericordia. And that's the etymology of the word mercy. We get that word mercy around the 6th century. So it started as three words becomes one word due to translation in the Bible. So in that one word, you have the four parts. You have the definition, okay? In about 400 AD, Saint Augustine gave a definition of mercy using three of those parts, all right? And then St. Thomas Aquinas would take that definition and add that fourth part in 1300 AD. So from 1400 BC to 1300 AD, that's 2,700 years it took to get this definition. God works slowly because we are slow. Okay? So that's the development. More importantly is the definition. What are these four parts? And why does it have to be four? We don't know how to define. We're not taught that in school. But the two main ways of defining go back 300 years before Christ. A pagan philosopher, among the very best of all time, Aristotle. And I use both kinds of definitions in the book. The definition of forgiveness has to do with a two-part definition. The definition of mercy has to do with that four-part definition. You have the material, you don't have to understand this. It's in the book though. The material cause, the formal cause, the efficient cause, the final cause. Okay? If you have those four causes, you have a complete definition. These days, kids don't know the difference between describing and defining. Okay, they want to know a definition if they saw it. So you're going to learn how to define. You're going to learn a lot more about forgiveness than the actual definition. One thing that's... There are several unique things about this book. One of them is that I'm treating this as it is, a mystery. It's not a broken, unforgiveness is not a broken vacuum cleaner that can easily be fixed. When you deal with a mystery, it's not just something beyond understanding, Okay? Even in heaven it's going to be full of mystery. But mystery touches on every aspect of the faith. You take any mystery, you can go, it will involve the whole catechism of the Catholic Church. The faith, the liturgy, morality, and prayer. And even beyond that, this book touches on psychology. It hits hard on psychology. It challenges certain Aristotelian ideas. It touches anthropology, logic. It hits a lot, okay? So, what's the first part of this definition? The material cause and the formal cause, I'll just give you an example. In the definition of a human person, the material cause would be your body, the formal cause would be your soul, okay? So the material cause is compassion. Compassion, according to Webster's dictionary, is a little more than we think. We know the idea of commiserating, to feel the misery, the pain, the suffering of another. We know that part. Did you know compassion also is a desire to alleviate that suffering? You have that desire. You might not be able to do that, to alleviate any of that suffering, but you have a desire to do that. That's compassion. The formal cause, which is the essence of the definition, is charity, the highest kind of love. Okay, so the definition you get in the confessional is to keep loving the sinner who hurt you. And that takes a whole chapter to talk about what charity is. We know it as loving God, loving our neighbor as Jesus loves us, okay, to participate in that love. There's more to it than that. So it's a compassionate charity. See, there's half your definition. The next part is going to be more complex. It's bending down to someone in misery. That doesn't sit well with some of our modern theologians because of our culture. We're not into this idea of bending down, going up. We see each other as equal to an extreme. Yes, we're all equal, but not absolutely, okay? The Good Samaritan had to bend down to the Jew that was beaten up so badly he was half dead. He literally bent down in order to lift him up. What beautiful imagery Jesus gave us. Bending down can also be understood figuratively, to meet the person where they're at. It might be on the fishing boat, it might be in the bar. Different people can be reached different ways. What works for one is not going to work for another. But in every case, Jesus met the person where that person was at. And that's what we got to do. To bend down we have the example of God himself. It's a word we don't like. The word condescension. Oh, you're so condescending, okay? There would be no Jesus if there had been no condescension. If God had not come down to us in our sinfulness. So mercy is sharing in that, participating in that. That takes humility, that lowliness. Bending down, stooping down, that's how it's explained in the book of Exodus when God saw the suffering of the Hebrew people. He stooped down, he bent down to see what was going on down there. Bending down to someone in misery. According to St. Thomas Aquinas, there's two kinds of misery. The miseries of the body and the miseries of the soul. The seven corporal works of mercy, seven spiritual works of mercy, of which forgiveness is one of those spiritual works of mercy. I challenge that way of thinking thanks to St. Paul. In his first letter to the Thessalonians, chapter 5. In this letter, he doesn't describe the human person as a twosome, but as a threesome. Soma, which is body, psyche, psyche, pneuma, which is spirit. We're in the image of God. We're a three in one. This is one of the ways we are in the image of God. So if our anthropology could be the human person as a twosome, then, yeah, St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, has those works of mercy. But there is a tradition in the church. There are church fathers that I quote who see the human person as a threesome. You could hold either position, and I explain how you can be a twosome and a threesome, how two can equal three, okay? It depends on how you see the soul, okay? Aristotle, of whom St. Thomas Aquinas quotes heavily, saw the soul as, in, I guess you could call it two parts, the higher soul, the spirit, so that when you die, it's the spiritual part that goes to the next life until it's reunited to the body. But there's also the lower soul, the psyche, the emotional part, okay, the psychological part. And so if you see man as a threesome, as woman as a threesome, then there's not just the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, there is the psychological works of mercy, the healing of the memory, the healing of the emotions. Okay, what good psychologists want to do. They're doing a work of mercy. If they're doing it with a compassionate charity, then they're doing a work of mercy. So a compassionate charity bending down to one in misery and lifting that person out of the misery. Jesus does this so many times. I have in the footnote, I have a whole list of places in the Bible where Jesus lifted people up. Okay? The church is called to participate in this lifting up. We as parishes and dioceses and within the parish, you know, groups within the parish and as individuals, we're called to be part of this lifting up of elevating people, getting them out of their misery, partially or even completely out of that misery, right? We're called to share in that. So there's your four-part definition. What are different kinds of mercy? What are distinctions you can make? Okay? According to St. Thomas Aquinas, first and foremost, mercy is said of God. He comes from the highest position. There's no higher position than that. And so he's going from the greatest distance downward, and he is the one that can heal all miseries, lift people out of their miseries. Also, he has the most charity, the most compassion. Does God have compassion? Well, read the book. Compassion means sharing in the misery of another. There's no misery in heaven. There's no sorrow. It's perfect joy. There's no bloody tears of Mary in heaven. Okay, that was here on earth. That's over with. She's not agonizing in heaven over her strayed children. Right? So how can God be compassionate? Good question. So he's got the most compassion, the most charity, the greatest distance downwards, and the best at lifting people up all the way to heaven, even the highest part of heaven, Our Lady. All right? We're called to share in that great work. So there is divine mercy, human mercy. The distinction I go into in most detail is this. There was a controversy that was going on in the 1200s, mainly between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. The Dominicans were saying Mary had to have sinned in order to be saved. Otherwise, how could she be saved? And the Franciscans were generally saying, no, she didn't commit any sin, but we can't explain how she was saved. All right? St. Thomas Aquinas, I found in his Summa, he has the principle, but he didn't apply it to Mary. That would come in about 1300 by a Franciscan, of all people, the ones that serve in the soup kitchens and sweep floors, they're not noted for being high-powered theologians. He made a brilliant distinction. Wisdom is being able to make distinctions, okay? The thinking regarding mercy, regarding salvation, is you're in the quicksand and someone comes, grabs you by the hand and pulls you out. You are delivered. You're pulled out of the misery, the physical misery, the psychological misery, the spiritual misery. What blessed, according to the Franciscans, blessed John Scotus said, there is another way. Preserving someone from ever going into the quicksand. Okay? Putting lumber over the quicksand, putting signs around, do not enter quicksand, to preserve people from falling into it. St. Therese talks about this in her book, The Story of the Soul. I quote her twice. This is one of those times. The perfect example of being preserved of all sin is Our Lady. And so I use this, I don't know if it's out there, this, I make the distinction between deliverance mercy and preservation mercy. Two ways we can experience God's mercy through others. In some ways, you can look back and say, I was preserved. Other ways, you can look back and say, I was delivered. These ways, I was delivered. So he added this notion of preservation to the understanding of mercy. Sometimes people have a bad connotation of condescension because it's phony. They can see it. They can see false mercy in politicians. They put on the apron, the nice photo op, there they are working at the soup kitchen, making it look like that's what they do on the side. But it's for votes, it's for popularity. They could care less about the poor. There's no compassion. And so this puts a bad taste in our mouth. We hate that which is false mercy, false compassion, false charity, a false bending down, a false lifting up. Something else about mercy, a good example of anti-mercy, you know, just the complete opposite was on Good Friday. Never in the history of mankind was there such anti-mercy. Crucify him! Okay. And a good example of non-mercy would be how the rich man omitted to help Lazarus. He had the opportunity, he had the time. He didn't have to go all the way to China or India or I don't know where. It was right outside his doorstep. He could say, I never hurt anybody. I never got my dog to go out there and bark at him. I never came at him with a stick. I didn't hurt anybody. Whether he ends up in hell or purgatory, people differ on that one. Okay, but he didn't go straight to heaven. So these are some of the distinctions. This is a basic idea of the definition and the basic development of mercy. And that's necessary for the definition. You gotta have mercy. If you don't know what mercy is, you don't know forgiveness. So this is what I would want to say to you in the confessional, on the pulpit, but you know, you don't have 45 minutes for a homily, okay? So that's why you got it here. So I'll let you know when I know something, unless I'm too depressed. But again, thank you for your prayers, and we'll see what happens, okay?